This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not constitute legal, tax, investment, financial, or other advice. It is not intended to cause or induce breach of an existing agency agreement.
Hello?
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 This is the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast.
And welcome back to Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Scalina.
And I'm your other host, Matt Scalina.
And Matt, this is episode 500. I can't believe it. We finally made it.
I know. We've been waiting for this day for a long time. I don't know how I feel. How do you feel?
I don't feel any different. Older? No, I definitely feel older than when we started this podcast. But yeah, not any older since episode 499. That's for sure.
It was a good break, though.
It was a very good break. Thanks for a few people who checked up on us to make sure we were still in existence, because it meant a lot. It meant that little gap was noticed. So definitely appreciate that. We have two amazing people on the show today. We've got two kind of legends in not only this podcast, but in kind of the talking head space in real estate in BC. We've got Brendan Augmanson, who's the chief economist of BCREA, or the British Columbia Real Estate Association. We also have Ryan Berlin, who is the chief economist at Rennie, which is incredible. So both these guys on the show today, we did it at the studio in Chinatown with Podfather there, and it was pretty great.
Yeah, what I love about this conversation, I mean, like you said, two past guest fan favorites of the highest esteem, but Ryan, being with Rennie, kind of is very attuned to the new construction space. So we get insights into the pre-construction market, we get insights into the shadow inventory and what that means for the market, and basically all things new construction, as well as the market. And then Brendan is the resale market, right? But then he brings up provincial, and Ryan has a little bit because Rennie's in other areas as well. But Brendan is literally all of BC. So we talk Lower Mainland, but there's some compare contrast with some other markets. And I think it just, we look back at 2025, we look into 2026, lots to unpack, and it's a great way to start the year.
Yeah, tons of takeaways in this episode. And yeah, like you said, it's all-encompassing. Like, we cover every aspect of the market. So definitely one to tune into. Before we get to that, Matt, as one listener of the show, to celebrate episode 500, he recommended we stay at his townhouse in Whistler, which was phenomenal. So we did a quick two nights there with the families. Taliswood 14 is the townhouse. And I got to say, Whistler, it's like sitting in a hot tub in a huge six-bed townhome for 2 days straight, when like the backdrop is basically Narnia. Like, it's just like trees and snow and incredibly beautiful. What a spectacular he did this just out of the kindness of his heart. And here's the thing. I didn't tell him I was going to do this, but if anyone is looking for a Whistler getaway, check out Taliswood 14 on Airbnb, because it is, I'll be going back for sure.
You know what? My wife is pretty hard to please. I will tell you that. And she loved that place.
Yeah.
She loved that place. I mean, she was like, when can we come back?
Same.
So here. Yeah, definitely a great spot. What else do we have before we get to Brendan and Ryan here?
Well, we have the segment that remains nameless.
We do, Adam. And I'm going to try something a little different today. It is a quiz question for you. I was thinking 500 episodes, I can call an audible. So here's a question for you. In today's market, there's a lot of new duplex projects out there, okay, where there's two units, Adam, and both are for sale, and neither have sold yet, okay?
Okay.
I'm seeing these across Vancouver. Is it better to be the first buyer or the second buyer in a new duplex project?
Ooh.
This is more philosophical.
Isn't this subjective? Okay. So, I mean,
there is an answer. But before we get to that, Adam, let's talk about one of our new listings, because I was just talking to somebody who's watching our Instagram yesterday. And we are now, we're back on Instagram in a big way, Adam. And she said, is it just you guys popping listings out like crazy, or are a lot of listings hitting the market right now? So let's talk about one of our listings quickly.
Yeah, Matt, this is 3337 West 40th. This is really the nicest duplex, I think, on the west side that's available right now, sub $3 million for sure. It's listed at 2599, so just tucked under 26. 2,300 square feet. Built in 2021, still relatively new, a couple years old, but no GST payable, which is incredible. So huge savings there. And then the nicest thing about this, and I was talking to a couple agents that, you know, that kind of have businesses focused on half duplexes on the east side and the west side that, you know, sell a lot of half duplexes. And all of them are blown away at the outdoor space for this place. So you get 1,700 square feet of a backyard space. It's completely private, amazing sun. They've got it all professionally landscaped. They spent like six figures landscaping the backyard. It is spectacular. And this level, like the quality of build, I think is, you know, as anyone who's looked at real estate in Vancouver knows, there's a lot of variation in build quality out there. This is really, really well executed. Like it's the type of place where you look and you're like, ah, somebody who built this really, really put a lot of care into and intention into everything from design to finished product. So yeah, super exciting. You can check it out at our website, VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
You can check it out there. You can also click sell with us where you can download the sold plan, start on launch date. This helps you get your property ready for market to get it sold in the quickest amount of time for the highest price. You just click sell with us over at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. Okay, Adam, back to our quiz question. That's not so much of a quiz question as more of a philosophical question.
Yeah.
Which do you do? Because, yeah, well, no, I'll leave it with you.
Well, okay, but this is why I think it's subjective. So I'm going to attack this from two angles. One, often back duplexes sell for a premium because they get typically the more private outdoor space, backyard. So, I mean, that's one consideration. So being first, you get first choice, right? I find depending on the duplex, but there's typically one that stands out as better from my experience as the better product or the better floor plan or just better situated away from the street. And the second point would be, it depends on, I guess, a rising or falling market, because if the market's rising, you want to be first in for sure, because, you know, presume there's a chance that someone will pay as much as you paid for an inferior unit or even more for a similar unit. Or if you flip that, you know, the reverse is true. If you're in first and it takes them 3 months to sell the second unit, they might sell it at a discount, right? So that's my logic. So I don't really have a choice.
Wait, first or second?
I think it's market contingent.
What's timestamp this? January 22nd today.
I would still, I honestly think I would still rather go first. And it's because I get the choice of the two duplexes and I get to carve out a deal that I'm satisfied with. And who knows what the second person does.
You know, Adam, I came up with this question because I was going to stump you. The answer is second. And it's because you want to know your neighbors and you want to look what they paid and grind a little bit harder and know you paid less than your neighbors.
Is that seriously, who came up with this? This is ridiculous.
I'm just thinking about this on the drive over to the studio. That it's tricky right now, right? Because if you see something sitting and you like it and both sides are available, you get to choose the best one. Then you're like, do I really feel like sitting and watching this other one sit? And what if they pay way less? You know, what
I happens? Think you're wrong. I seriously think you're wrong because the reason I think you're wrong is because it's an end user product. So I think people really care about getting the right property as end users. You're thinking about it from like an investor perspective. Like, who cares if you save 20 grand and get the less attractive unit?
Right, right. No, point taken. Anyway, the answer was second. You were at 84%. You're now at 81%. We're moving into the 500s. Anyway, Adam, let's talk to two chief economists, Brendan Augmentson and Ryan Berlin.
Yeah, and let's change the name of the segment that remains nameless to the segment that sucks. All right, see you on the other side.
Attention realtors, home buyers, and investors. If you missed out on Atlin at Clayton Crest by Zentera Developments, here's your second chance.
Atlin sold 80% in just 3 months, Adam. And because of that success, Zentera is launching Building 2, Butte.
Located in West Clayton and walking distance to the future SkyTrain station, prices are still low for now, but not for long.
Homeowners across the Lower Mainland are using equity from their current homes to invest in West Clayton, ahead of the SkyTrain and the next market upswing, because when that SkyTrain is complete and the market rebounds, it'll be too late.
This, Matt, is how wealth is built. Find out why Atlin sold so fast and register now at buttecondos.ca. That's B-U-T-E condos.ca.
Hi, I'm Michael Yu.
And I'm Morgan Brown. And we're the founders of Oakland Realty. We have 9 offices across British Columbia.
Serving all major markets of BC. If you're an agent out there, just like Adam and Matt, who happen to be licensed at Oakland, please reach out to us at oakland.com/join and type into that message box, the rep, and you'll receive a free gift and a promotion when you meet one of our leaders.
Thanks so much. And we're looking forward to meeting with you.
See you soon.
Okay, we're here with Ryan Berlin, Chief Economist at Rennie, and Brendan Augmanson, Chief Economist from the BCREA, or the British Columbia Real Estate Association. Thanks so much for taking the time. Episode 500, we couldn't think of anyone better we'd like to have on the show, so great to have you here, and we got a perfect roundtable opportunity here. So,
what an honor.
Congratulations on 500. I'm honored to be sharing a table with the great Ryan Berlin. So.
Well, both past guests, two past guests, two fan favorites. It's great having you here.
Can we start for our listeners that maybe haven't heard you guys? You've both been on the show a number of times, but can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Do you want me to start?
Yeah.
Okay. I am the chief economist of the BC Real Estate Association. We're an industry association that represents realtors, 26, 27,000 realtors, whatever the count is across BC. We do advocacy, education, and I handle our economics group where we report on market stats and do original economic research and speak to the public and the media and do podcasts.
Perfect. Yeah, so I'm the chief economist at Rennie. Rennie is a real estate services company. We're in pre-sale or new home sales and marketing. We're in resale as a brokerage. We do advisory, so essentially fee-based consulting, and we do lease-ups. And so I run our intelligence group, and I do all the things that Brendan does, but not as many of them. Not as many.
Just better.
Yeah.
Just better.
Yeah, it's quality over quantity. Not true.
So one of the reasons, I mean, regardless of the different takes on the market, we were going to have you two on just because it will make for a great conversation. But of course, Brendan, you're kind of more in the resale side of things. Ryan, you focus on the resale, but also Rennie, of course, is focused on pre-construction. So there's going to be two different takes on the market. So maybe I'll just put it out there and Brendan, you can start. Just how bad was 2025?
It was really, really bad. And it depends on what, you know, we cover all of BC. So, you know, this is the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'll probably just primarily talk about Vancouver. Worst year for sales since the year 2000. If you include the Fraser Valley, similar story, you know, worst year for sales in 25 years. Listings are higher. Unsold new inventories, maybe Ryan will talk about, is at a 35-year high across BC. I think in Vancouver, maybe it's similar. So yeah, it was one of the worst. It's the worst year of the century. Let's put it in like the most dramatic terms.
There's the headline.
But the good news, I guess, worst year for sales in the century and all these inventory issues, prices were down like 3%. So also a remarkably resilient market in terms of pricing.
Was it just to dig a little bit deeper, because you focus on the province and we will focus primarily on the Lower Mainland, but how unique was the Lower Mainland in that story in terms of badness?
Pretty unique. You know, other markets had a similar downturn after like the tariff uncertainty shock hit. It was just the magnitude was far, far different in the Lower Mainland. And the duration of that shock was longer. It just took, Metro Vancouver really never got off the mat. like other markets, like Victoria had kind of a normal year. Vancouver Island had kind of a normal year. The interior actually finished the year really strong. It's like the Okanagan, Kamloops, Kootenai. The North was like, what's uncertainty? What's a tariff? They had a really good year. So yeah, the Metro Vancouver was very different. We did, there's this kind of famous economics paper. I think it's, I just ran a million regressions. We did something, not a million regressions, but a bunch of like modeling to find, try and figure out like what explains this difference right. in performance. Just struck out on basically everything. I think a big part of it is like investors fled the market. You know, usually investors are in the resale market, like 15-20% of sales. They're just not around. The returns aren't there, obviously. We can talk about what's going on the immigration side and like what that means for the rental market and what that, you know, if you're looking to be a landlord and forecasting what your returns might be or how difficult it might be to get a tenant, what that's done to investor demand, what regulations like the short-term rentals have done to investor demand. So yeah, a lot of, I think, maybe things at least short-term correlate with the downturn in the metro area versus the rest of BC. But it's really hard to like say like, what is wrong with the Vancouver market right now? It's not just affordability either, because like, Victoria is the second most expensive market in the province, and they had a pretty normal year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So also, my coffee consumption is out of control to start 2026.
Fantastic.
So I might be talking really fast.
Brennan's fired up. Yeah. Ryan, your take. Because I know you guys are elsewhere other than Vancouver, but you're primarily Vancouver.
Yeah, so. We're Vancouver, Kelowna, and Victoria. But you know, I do think that, you know, how do you measure it? But the confidence in the market isn't there. There's no swagger. You know, I don't think that at this point anyone would be excited to sit down with their buds and say, hey, I just bought, guess what, guys? I bought an investment condo. Isn't that cool? Yeah, isn't that great? Yeah. Everyone kind of be like, really? How does that work for you? Because, you know, I think there was a belief for a long time, and it generally played out, you know, through cycles that values were increasing. You know, we look at benchmark condo prices. I mean, all benchmark prices in the Vancouver region, so it's like the Vancouver and the Fraser Valley board areas, benchmark prices for townhomes, detached homes, and condos peaked in the spring of 2022. There were a couple, if we look at condos, that's the space I'm mostly focused on. If you look at the path that prices have taken in essentially resale, there was a couple of almost attempts to get back to the peak. There was some movement back, and then prices would fall again. And right now, I think benchmark condo prices are 10% below May 2022 levels. So you look at that and you go, yeah, like, so if you're an investor and the unit never cash flowed in the first place, which has been the case for years.
Right.
But, you know, you look at it and you go, well, maybe interest rates will come down if you're somebody that bought in the last few years, and you'll go, I'll renew in 5 years. I'll have a lower outstanding balance. I'll have a new tenant. Rents will be, the market will be higher, but also because I can turn it over, I can, you know, maybe make a jump there and I'll get in the black in 5 years.
Yeah.
But, you know, all the while, the value of my home's going up. So I'll do it. I can chip into this unit and cover that difference. I just don't think people are willing to do that now. That's a very qualitative sort of take on things. But I do think that colors both the resale and the presale market. Yeah.
Even in like a rational expectations kind of thing, like if you're like forecasting your returns, your capital appreciation, maybe inflation if you're lucky,
yeah,
and rents are falling. So your two kind of components of your return are like, where does this make sense?
Yep.
But it's funny because yesterday we were talking about this podcast and one of the notes that I made was like vibes.
It's true. Yeah.
Like it's just,
like vibe session, right?
Vibe bad. Yeah.
But like there's the rational, because I think it's true, right? If you're like, man, I have to feed this thing $300 a month, but in the next 3 years, it's going to do 10% on 500 grand. You're up 50K like that. Okay. I'll take that bet. Yeah. But when that is not there, it doesn't make sense. But then there's that vibes like no one wants to talk about real estate at the party anymore. And if you bring it up, it's like,
and are you
time to go home early?
The other thing is it's not liquid anymore. Like you can't sell it. Like it's right across the board. And your silver ETF just did 88% or whatever, right? So it's like
exactly
like that's, I mean, it's not sexy right now.
And policy has boxed things in, right? So it's like it's changed that relationship. The layers of policy, like municipal through regional, provincial, federal, changed the risk reward relationship. The reward is no greater and is diminished today than it was years ago. You I'm being vague there on how far we're going back, but there are so many more risks because to your point, you can't necessarily offload, if you needed to, your property at a particular time, either because you need to get out, because you want to realize a certain return and redeploy that capital into something else. You are kind of stuck. Yes. More than you have been in the past.
I think that's the difference in the Vancouver market versus some of the smaller markets that had normal-ish years. They just don't have that investor base, yeah. Right?
And that's why it's in the pre-sale market, that's why we see wood frame continuing to plod along for a whole bunch of reasons. You know, the revenue thresholds for sales are lower than high-rise concrete. The buildings have fewer units, so you have to get through fewer in either 12 months or 18 months. Usually the wood frame is 12 months. But, you know, it wasn't investors who were making that segment of the market viable in the first place. So when the investors went away, it was like, okay, you know, it's still an end user market. And so more of those projects are viable. Like, we probably won't see a high-rise concrete launch this year.
Yeah. Which is like when you have all government policy about transit-oriented density, yeah, and towers around. Right. It's like, fantastic. Well, okay, yeah. Where does the investor, where do you get the capital from?
Yeah.
Is a question that the government has never answered.
I think this is just interesting just to cover people that are not in the market and are just listening, though. If I'm hearing this correctly, so the strongest markets are the markets that would be more end-user focused traditionally.
More resilient.
Yeah, more resilient. Yeah. And there's still more activity in those markets. So the weakest segments are like you hear people in the media call dog crate condos or
and even just concrete high rises.
Concrete high rises. And then you're still seeing activity, which we've talked a lot on this show, in like, say, more ground oriented housing in the lower mainland and then in areas that haven't been.
But it's interesting that what's taking place in Metro Vancouver, which you just explained, is actually just, it's like a microcosm for the province, because the markets where it's just people moving through the market, buying and selling homes, not really investor focused, are actually just performing like regular markets.
Right.
The uncertainty storyline doesn't necessarily apply.
Yeah. Well, if you look at like from the perch of 2024, when things were like, oh, we were really optimistic about 2025. So there was like an effect, like a lot of those markets outside of the North and the Kootenai, where like affordability is really just drives everything. So those are the two most affordable markets in the province. Sales were in like some other markets still down like 10, 15% below like a 10-year average when we thought they were going to be closer to a 10-year average. So there was an effect. It's just not 30% like Vancouver.
Yeah. So if we say 15 to 20% of Metro Vancouver's investor, right? Like, I think one of you...
It's like, is that, well, I mean, in the... Yeah, I mean, up until 2023, it was in the new home, like higher the pure that, yeah, pre-sale space, it was about 50%.
Okay,
yeah, right? Wow,
50. So,
but it's now down below 20%.
Okay, so below 20% now, up to 50%. I guess I'm trying to think of if either one thing has to happen. They have to come back.
Yeah.
Or the entire kind of model has to shift away from relying on those investors. And I guess... A, which one occurs, crystal ball, but B, how long does it take to shift that model away from investors? Like, is that the next 5 years? Is that like, feel like that's like a moving the ship, you know, to turn it around type thing, right? Like, is that a decade?
I mean, are we talking about an intentional shift where policy is creating incentives? I don't know. I think I don't see the conditions materializing in the market in a way that will all of a sudden be conducive to investing in real estate again.
Right.
You know, people will always do it for all kinds of reasons, right? There's like safety of capital, perceived safety of capital. You know, you might be buying your kid a home to live in for university. You might not be sophisticated in how you calculate an ROI for yourself. And listen, if you put down a big down payment, maybe you're positive cash flowing on day one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
right. Well, you know, and that's going to work for people. And, you know, you look at, all of this has been what's been happening in our housing market has happened alongside equities markets that have been going gangbusters. And like, you know, I'm talking to my financial advisor. I'm like, hey, man, when do we get out? Because like this is something's wrong here, right? Like this is, it's not going to persist indefinitely, but there have been enough gains for long enough period of time where people are going, it's way sexier to put your money in tech stocks than it is housing.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. And I think in the short term too, like, you know, affordability is going to kind of drive some of that recomposition. So like the Fraser Valley probably is the best affordability. Like when we talk about the Fraser Valley, for people who are listening who don't pay attention to real estate boards. We mean Surrey and Langley and Abbotsford, not Chilliwack. For some reason.
Of course not.
So in the Fraser Valley Real Estate Board area, affordability is the best it's been in 5 years, not just because prices, the benchmark price is back to 2021 levels.
Yeah.
Whereas like Vancouver's not. Like Vancouver's like not down. If you're talking about Metro Vancouver, like the GVR area, prices aren't down very much at all. Fraser Valley, they're down a lot from peak, and rates are lower than they were 5 years ago, or not 5 years ago, but 2-3 years ago. Mm-hmm. So affordability is actually much better in the Fraser Valley. And that's a market that also has demographic pressures that are real. I mean, right. I did a presentation for the Surrey Board of Trade, and I was just looking at their demographics, and this is your area. So if I step in a line, let me know. But the most common age in Surrey is 22. Right? Like, so if you're more likely to bump into a 22-year-old than any other age in Surrey, right?
In Vancouver, it's 62?
Yeah. And the top five ages, though, were all like in their 20s. So shift 10 years that's from now, nuts. Like, that's a lot of housing demand in a huge market where affordability is better. So I think we're going to have some people getting back into the market just as confidence comes back, uncertainty fades, and affordability is better than it has been in some time. The part with investors, though, is if we don't address the problems that are happening right now, we're releasing some research about this, I think, this month. If we repeat the cycle of the 2010s, last time we had this huge spike in inventory, building stopped, like as everyone kind of expects to happen over the next few years. We don't resupply the market. Supply starts to dwindle as it did in that period. And then we get another price acceleration. So in our like simulations, by like 2029, we get to a situation where, like, you know, there's a lot of like, you know, dry material on the ground, and anything could spark a run up in prices. So if you get demand really coming back, as it inevitably does, especially in a market with our demographic pressures, you can see prices really start to accelerate by the end of this decade.
There's a line in the world of demographics that I use occasionally, which is like one certainty, which is every year, pretty much everyone gets a year older. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So far.
You want to be getting a year older.
What about that guy? Oh, yeah. He's trying to live forever.
He's going backwards?
He's trying to live forever.
He is. Honestly,
I hope he gets hit by a bus. not really. Yeah. But kind of.
But there's something similar that applies to the new home space, right? Because we look at pre-sale counts. Well, I'll say new home sales because really there are far fewer true pre-sales today than there are sales of newly completed units and units that are in buildings that are under construction. But over the last 4 years, we've seen a stepwise down decline in new home sales. And again, this is how we deliver housing, right? In big numbers, is through the multifamily segment. And that specifically, the pre-sale market is critical to our ability to deliver. And you have 4 years of decline, you're at a little over 6,000 new home sales last year, probably only 2,000 pre-sales. And you look at that and you think those units that are selling in buildings that haven't started construction, they're spread out over dozens of projects, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not like they're concentrated in one project or a handful of projects where you go, okay, now they're viable. Now they can get their construction financing from the bank. They can start building. We know they're going to deliver, right? The homes are going to be there. A lot of these projects are going to fall by the wayside, right? So we are certainly going to see fewer homes. Rental is a different conversation, but in the ownership space, in the pre-sale space, the new home deliveries, we're going to see them decline over the next 3 to 4 years. Absolutely. There's no other way it can be.
And what does that mean? Like, I'm just trying to think of what that means for concrete towers moving forward, though, until investors come back. Do they go extinct, or do we change the composition of the units, or do we, like, what's the direction of concrete?
That's a good question. I mean, even if you sub in, like, the government is the primary lender and they say, hey, we'll guarantee you this money, you just build. It's still like, what's the value prop there if you don't even think, you know, you've got 300 units in your building, and what if it takes you 10 years to sell it? Why would you tie up the capital?
It becomes like a China model. Like, let's just build all
all
these towers. Empty. Yeah. They're empty.
Empty city.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's, I don't know, unfortunately, what the path is out of this right now, but we're a bit stuck.
I remember there was, and it's interesting because I don't know how Calgary, I guess the one thing about Calgary is that they're not building up, they're building out, right? And I think that's one of the bigger differences. But I remember the downturn in Alberta when Battistella, you remember when we had Battistella back on the podcast like years ago?
Yeah.
And they were going first to build a concrete tower, but it had been like years since anybody had done anything and since kind of the market had really, really softened. And I remember how kind of stressed out everybody in that market seemed. But it's different in Vancouver though, because we're not, it's, I mean, it's a totally different model, but what is it going to take that is, we're going to have to find someone who's very brave to come back into concrete towers, I think.
But even the people who launched last year.
Yeah.
Like pivoted away, right? Or a lot of them did.
Yeah.
Not all of them. I guess West Group and Port Moody, I think, was pretty successful, but there was some towers that flopped.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, REDMA, the Real Estate Development Marketing Act, that says that you must have secured your construction financing within 12 months of filing a disclosure statement, essentially like making the homes available for sale. For projects under 100 units or up to 18 months, if your project has more than 100 units, is constrained. I mean, it adds to the calculus, right? For, if you're a developer, you got to thread this needle. You've got to sell, if it's a concrete high rise, you've got to sell by revenues, you know, call it 60, 65% of the building in 18 months.
Yeah.
And if not, you got to pull back and you go like, is it worth, you know, that's years lost if you're pulling the plug at the end, right? So,
well, like, so just thinking about, to go back to, I think, Brendan, you said this idea of like a lot of kindling and dry matter by 2029. What about immigration numbers? Because I feel like that's one of those stories where it's like, okay, you know, Surrey's average age 22. I feel like there's clear demographic pressures there. The province is losing people right now.
Yeah, it's important to look at the composition though, too, for housing markets,
yeah. Right? So can we talk about that a little bit? Like how...
Yeah, I was just looking at the net migration numbers yesterday. And like we, Ryan and I talked throughout this year about like, I don't think Canada's going to be able to hit these numbers. They're looking at, the government of Canada wants to get the share of non-permanent residents, that's mostly temporary foreign workers and international students, down from like, what is it, 8% of the population down to 5%, which sounds like not a huge move, but it's like 900,000 people or something that they would like to engineer an outflow out of the country. First couple of quarters was like pretty light. I think they were at like, I don't know, 50,000 net negative for Canada. But then like the third quarter was like negative 150,000. So like they ramped up in the third quarter and BC as well. Like for BC, just its normal share, maybe it's like 70,000 people out a year. Like Stats Canada had a report out a couple months ago that 99% essentially of non-permanent residents are renters. So there's not really an effect besides on investors in the resale market. But we're completing a kind of a historic amount of rental units and we're sending renters out of the country. No surprise in 2025, Vancouver and Victoria had like their highest levels of vacancy in decades. And it's probably going to go higher, right? Over the next, because of policy. We're going to have the first decline in Canadian population since Confederation. Mm-hmm. That has lots of downstream effects on the macro economy as well. Fewer people in the country means fewer people spending, fewer people working for the purpose of. Kind of unclear.
Well, this is, I was going to say, like, I'm not an economist, but what is the, it struck me when we added a million people in a year, like you could feel the impact on your day-to-day life where you're like, life is worse right now. Sure. I can't get into the doctor or whatever.
Yep.
But like right now it's like, is there an economic logic to this?
Policy just works with like, they overreacted too many job vacancies. Yeah. Let's fill them right now. There's a million jobs vacant. We got to fill them. And then the market took care of that. And then we were left with all these people that we are in the country. That puts a lot of pressure on the rental market. And then now we're like overreacting in the other way. Like, let's get these people out of the country as fast as possible.
Well, and that's the thing I can't get my head around. I mean, this is why I'm not in politics. Cause I mean, I get it. I think they're trying to fix this problem, this challenge that was creation of the federal government.
Yeah.
There have always been plans for permanent resident targets. There were no guardrails or plans or ideas about, you know, what is the right number of non-permanent residents? What is the composition of them? But I would say, you know, be wary of policy that's predicated on round numbers. Okay. So that means not a lot of thinking went into it, but they came up with something that's sellable, right? But why should non-permanent residents be 5% of the population? Yeah. Why shouldn't they be 6? Why shouldn't they be 2? I mean, just somebody, you know, let's make that analysis transparent and we can get on board. And then the second part of that is, well, what is a reasonable timeline for, you know, shifting from where we are to where we want to be? Why, you know, the government said originally when they said that 5% target for non-perms, they said it was going to be achieved by the end of this year.
Right.
Right. Yeah. And then they were like, oh, you know, like the first year that plan really got off to a rocky start. And it was like, oh, yeah, no, we're never going to hit that. So it gave themselves a mulligan and they pushed it out a year. But, you know, again, it was saying like as dramatic as that uptick was, that that net intake was of non-permanent residents, this is equally dramatic. And that you see post-secondary institutions, that whole sector being unable to adjust, right? If you're making change, if, whether it's changes to interest rates, which would be more market-based than policy-based, or you're making policy changes that change the calculus within, say, the investment cycle, however you want to define that, whether it's like, you know, you're talking about CapEx in universities, you're talking about developers going from acquisition to ultimately to sales and completion, you're creating challenges I don't think you need to make.
It's interesting too, because like we have like policy that's kind of at odds. Man, maybe like the CMHC is offering, you know, as much money and at the most favorable terms as possible for purpose-built rental. Mm-hmm. At the same time that we're like, we need fewer renters. So yeah. Like, are those projects still viable years down the road? Like, I don't know. Like it's, I mean, obviously the terms of the loans are really favorable, but like, yeah, it's like it seems like no one in government ever talks to each other about what is the goal.
Yeah.
But maybe the goal is, maybe it's a 5 or 6% vacancy rate. And
but even rent. If
but, it, well, why?
Why? I don't know.
Yeah. But A, why, but also, vibes. But, but even from just when we were talking about the positives of immigration, it was like aging population, the general economic benefit of immigration, like all that stuff's just now doesn't apply.
Well,
like,
I do think, I mean, so we're talking about non-permanent residents. There are permanent resident targets that are in place for each of the next 3 years, including this one at approximately 380,000, which if you take out the number of permanent residents that we welcome between 2021 telephone pole problem here at 4 years between 2021 and 2024. If you take out those 4 years, these targets going forward would be the highest numbers in our history, right? So there is still an acknowledgement, an explicit one, that immigration is important to the country for cultural reasons, social reasons, economic reasons.
Right.
But this particular piece of that, which is detached from the PR targets, it has not been well thought of.
What about, can we revisit then I think Rennie made this famous, but the wealth transfer. And I mean, mm-hmm. I feel like we've over the last few years, we've talked about kind of we're in the early stages of the wealth transfer. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. The data sucks on this.
Yeah. It's really bad. It's really bad.
Yeah. I mean, the number, like essentially what you're referring to is, you know, we look at Metro Vancouver and we say, okay, well, how many homeowners have clear title, right? No debt on the home. It's 40% of owners. It's not a small number. It's 40%. We got 1 million households in Metro Vancouver. Call it 600,000 are owners. And 2 out of 5 of those are, so you call it like 250,000 households are mortgage free, the owner occupiers. And we say, okay, well, how much is your home worth? And how old are you? And yeah, I mean, there is over $400 billion in mortgage-free equity in this region. And I can't remember off the top of my head now, the 75 plus group holds about a quarter of it. That's right. It holds about a quarter of it. And we looked at, you know, over the past decade being, you know, from the most recent census to the, so 2021 back to
2016,
20, if I can do the math, 20,
5 years,
10 years back to 2011. Hmm. Those 75 plus mortgage-free households between those 2 years over the decade, we say released, we don't know where it went, but $500 million of that mortgage-free equity every month.
Oh, jeez.
Right? And so where does that money go? Well, they might have moved out of the region. They might have passed away. They might be renting now. They might have purchased a new, like, we don't know. Did it go to their kids? But there's a lot of money there. To resources to support some activity in the housing market, but my big concern with all that is what we're seeing then is that dumbbell kind of market where you have the haves and the have-nots, right?
Yeah, and see, like the money is like the wealth is clearly there. We have no idea where it goes. Yeah, that's kind of the difficulty. And like the wealth by age data is like okay at the national level and then like non-existent at the provincial level. And even the national level is not awesome. It's interesting you're talking about the share of mortgages. Like City of Vancouver, I think it's like 55% don't have a mortgage, I think, in the City of Vancouver. And so like when you talk about Metro Vancouver, Surrey is 68% of owners. So like we did some work, this is getting a bit off the wealth topic, about mortgage renewals. I don't know if you guys want to talk about mortgage renewals. Looking at where the risks are. Like, so we have this risk matrix we put together of where are the markets where you have a lot of owner households with mortgages and where affordability is bad. It's like, that's like the higher risk kind of quadrant in our, yeah, in our chart. So like Squamish, I think like 74% of households have a mortgage because it's a really young community,
yeah, yeah,
and affordability is not great. So like your bank calls you up and says your mortgage payment's going up 20%. You know, maybe there's a risk there that you list your home. Probably not going to default, but maybe you cut back on your spending or you have to list your home in the worst case. On the other end of the spectrum, like Parksville, like 39% of owners have a mortgage. So most don't because it's Parksville, right? So like, you know, Surrey is kind of close to the higher end, City of Vancouver, and most of like what we look at the GVR area, like Burnaby, Richmond, City of Vancouver are all kind of like in the bad affordability, but not a lot of mortgages,
huh,
kind of quadrant. So,
so Fraser Valley, the prices have come down, but also the mortgage risk is highest.
Yeah, that's the market that has the most, because again, most of this is just demographics. Mm-hmm. Like there's just a lot of young families that are going to have mortgages. So yeah, the Fraser Valley has like some of the higher risk. And then there's like Langford also randomly has like a very high share of mortgages as well.
And within that too, it's just that I don't know if your data, mm-hmm, if you're able to get into it, I somehow doubt it. You know, how much leverage is there?
Yeah, no, that would be like, that would be great data.
Yeah, I mean, like if you're a young family and you just bought, yeah, you benefited from the bank of mom and dad, yeah, but
that's,
you know,
that's what we're trying to get at with the affordability part is like, you're probably going to have to use a lot of leverage if affordability is poor, because we don't have like, you know, bank data on like, you know, share of mortgages with a, you know, 4.5 times income or whatever.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of all the other forces for demand, because there was always the argument that, well, immigration, always the argument for the wealth transfer.
Yeah, yeah. Let's go run through them.
I was thinking, yeah, like, yeah. Welcome back to Mythbusters.
There's the economy. There's the economy as well. Like, what? Like if the economy, yeah, the picks economy up and creates jobs and income gains, then that, yeah, that tends to help. Unfortunately,
how optimistic are you there?
Yeah,
I was at Forecast Council in December, and I think the consensus was that BC is going to grow about 1.3%. So that'd be 3 straight years of growth with a one handle. So not a recession, but like really stagnant,
yeah,
really stagnant economy.
This is the other thing. Would a provincial government change, hypothetically, could the Conservatives come in, pull a bunch of different levers, and change the outlook of this market?
You want to take that?
I mean, right, so I'm just thinking,
I
like,
didn't want to ask.
Some of this is like, yeah, some of this is just time. Like,
yeah,
mm-hmm, a good way to think about economic growth is the sum of how many people you have working, how much, so just hours worked, your hours worked growing, and how much stuff can we produce out of each one of those hours. And that's productivity growth. Over the next year, mostly because of immigration policy, we're gonna have negative hours worked. You know, if we don't have strong employment growth and like with fewer people working, we could have negative hours worked and our productivity is kind of famously poor, mm-hmm, as well. So there's just these huge headwinds. You don't fix productivity overnight. Hope, you know, that when you talk about like on the political side of things, maybe there's some things that a provincial government can do.
Specifically policy related.
Yeah, but like it gets buried into like the weeds, like we could exempt investment in like machinery and equipment from PST. Because if you're paying tax on your inputs to production, you're going to invest less in that machinery and equipment. All like, you know, literature shows that investment in machinery and equipment tends to be good for productivity, right, growth. You know, more capital intensity is good for productivity growth. And we currently tax the ability for businesses in BC to invest in machinery, right? So we do really dumb things like that. Same thing with like interprovincial trade, which everyone was very excited about for about 3 months this year. You never heard about it again.
Yeah.
Once the sort of tariff threat was like, oh, there's still a free trade agreement. We don't have to worry about this anymore. And now you have like Doug Ford saying he's going to take Crown Royal off the shelves because they're closing up. Like it's so dumb. We do all these things with all this low-hanging fruit that we could help on the productivity side. So that's a long-term thing. Short-term, there's a lot of headwinds. Like, immigration policy alone is a major headwind to economic growth. The residential construction is a major headwind. We have all these units that need to be sold. They're not going to, developers aren't going to keep building. They can't sell what's already on the market. So that's going to slow down. We have a government that's running a very large budget deficit. They probably have to make some cuts in their budget a month. That's another headwind because government spending and investment has been the main driver of growth in 2023 and 24. And once the data comes out, I'm sure in 2025 as well, while private sector investment's been negative.
Yeah.
So change in government, maybe a change in philosophy about spending and taxes, maybe you're kind of though comparing to a hypothetical government. I'm not sure that coalition exists on either side in BC right now. So there are better policies. That doesn't mean that a change in government would bring them about.
And to your point too about timelines here, like we're going through a rough patch. The conditions that have created this, I don't think will persist indefinitely.
Yeah, exactly.
In fact, if you look at, immigration, for example, like we talk about this, I mean, frankly, stupid timeline that the federal government's working on to flush out the non-permanent residents. Okay, well, let's say they achieve it. Okay, well, from that point forward, we're likely to see a little bit of net growth, like some sort of a policy that essentially maintains non-permanent residents at about 5% of the population going forward. And maybe there's little tweaks to it, but we're likely to see, we'll see more stability, might see a bit of growth there. But again, our population will continue to grow. So that negative is going to come off the books. And all the underlying, everything else that's underlying, which is, I mean, frankly, mostly just immigration. We're not having kids. More of us are dying every year, right? We're getting older. Yeah. So we're not replacing ourselves per se, but immigration is the driver. So when you take the drag off, that is that net outflow of NPRs, then we return to what would we consider more normal growth, right? And so I think that's one of the preconditions. I think we've gone through a period now where inflation, but then really interest rates have gone up, they've come down. It's once bitten, twice shy.
Yeah.
I think people, like, for 40 years, you thought you saw your home values go up, 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 up as interest rates came down, 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 down. No one thought that we would see higher interest rates ever again. That was a wrong assumption. And I think now there's more caution. And interest rates themselves are not going to save us. Like, if you look at the 08, 09 price downturn, and then the one that originated in 17, 18 and we came out of at the beginning of COVID because everyone went nuts in the housing market, we had interest rate cuts supporting those return to previous peak values. We're not going to get that this time, but we should have more stability in interest rates going forward.
I think stability is a good word generally. Like, the economy kind of wants to grow at like a 2.5% rate. Like, historically, that's the average. It's actually a little bit higher rate of growth in BC. But we have all these shocks that kind of push you off that trend, right? And right now, we got all these shocks that have hit. We're waiting for them to kind of diffuse, and then you get back to trend, hopefully. So we're kind of on that path now. Once population growth resumes at a normal level, 2027, 28, whatever it's going to be, we've got the LNG exports that are going to really start to ramp up. That's going to add, diversify our export base and grow our export base. You got all these major projects from the Build Canada that have been greenlit or fast-tracked. So, like, there are things down the road. We're just in this, like, real soft patch because of we've been hit by shock after shock after shock. And those sort of pile on top of each other. And we're just trying to get back to, like, a normal kind of stable economy.
Do you guys have, and this is maybe not an economist question, but, rough patch, soft patch, where we are right now. Definitely in a patch. It's not a good patch.
Are there any good patches?
When do we get back to a good patch? But one of the, a lot of these things that these things that are in the works that we're going to get to a better place. The one thing that we've been talking a little bit about and trying to think about is Vancouver as a global city, like the idea of Vancouver as a global city. And I guess there's a bunch of things. One is just this kind of move towards deglobalization. It seems like immigration in Canada, but over the world is tightening up, right? It just feels like we're pushing away from where we were. Does Vancouver become a global city again? And I mean, not that it's not a global city, but no one's hyping it the way it was. Like, oh my God, we're the next whatever. We're one of these superstar cities or an aspiring superstar city. That language doesn't feel like it's meaningful or exists anymore. Like, we're more provincial. So if the economy improves, does Vancouver regain its place, or are we just more of a provincial backwater? That might be overstating Vancouver's role.
We are hosting the World Cup.
Yeah.
We got the overflow.
That's exactly. I don't know. I think Vancouver will remain a global city. It's funny, just even like little things when you hear people, I was listening to, it was Bill Simmons talking about like watching movies and like you had to go to these like cool cities and stuff. And he starts naming cities and he named Vancouver. And you hear that more and more, like people talk about like, oh, Vancouver, that's a good place to visit, whatever. So I think it is like where it is in some rankings. I don't know. It's hard to be a global city also when you like hang up a please don't come here or invest in here sign, right? So like some of this is just policy saying like, we don't want you here in that like world getting smaller kind of way. I don't think that's like going to be the trend going forward.
So it's part of the rough patch.
It's a patch of some kind. Yeah.
It's a patch. Yeah, I mean, we're still, you look at geographically where we are, the climate, the proximity to, you know, large markets across the ocean and deep pools of demography. Is that even a term? Deep pools of demography. Lots of people. Sure. It's a different way of putting it. We got deep water ports. We have resources. It's just a matter of how do we activate our assets, right, in a way, and leverage them in ways that we haven't maybe in the past. But, you know, again, I think there's a bit of a smoke screen, but it's a bit of a, or maybe it's a bit of a red herring. We look at how our population's changing right now. I'm going back to the non-perms, but take that out of the mix. We're a growing region. People want to be here. So the question is like, what kind of jobs do we have? You know, a lot of the affordability concerns, cost of living issues, taken care of if you're making more money, right?
Yeah, it's like this chart in my current presentation deck called Why Is Everyone So Mad All the Time in one chart. And it's just like wages in 2021 and then food and shelter costs in 2021. Oh, and like, yeah, you know, food and shelter costs are 30% yeah, wages are up like 20%, right? Yep. So, you know, and it's especially like, you know, Brian, you was posted this the other day, but like coffee and beef prices like really hurt. Like coffee prices are up. I don't know if you go to the store to get steak and it's like, well, you have to
$50
take out a second mortgage. Yeah, like, it's incredible how much it's gone up.
You're buying price. Goat?
You gotta look for some substitutions, right? Like, what's the next best animal? So yeah, like no wonder people are like generally just kind of upset because you know, they're working really hard and like it's just not keeping up because the price level shifted so much. You know, like sure, inflation's back to trend or to target, but still stuck with the
prices. You still have to deal with what's happening.
The prices are still high.
Yeah, they're still high. Hunting licenses have gone through the roof.
That's right. Start living off the land.
One thing, I don't know if you have, I think we got to get to 2026 forecast at one point.
I think we should, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
This might be a long one. I'm curious because if Rennie's looking at cost to build, because another thing that we used to hear all the time, we've heard over the last 10 years, and this is our 10th year of podcasting, so is that prices can't come down because we just can't build it for less, right? But now, actually, I'm seeing like trades are looking for work, and presumably it's you know,
yeah, and rough
economy. I'm not renovating anything, but I would imagine it would be easier to renovate today than it was in say 2021 or 2019 or whenever, right? So are you monitoring this? Has it become more affordable to build?
At the margin, it's becoming more affordable, but it's still very expensive. And when you layer in the costs, like, you know, there in parts of this region, if you don't even include land costs, you can't sell for less than $1,000 a square foot, right? Just because of your cost that includes, you know, fees and charges and taxes as well, which, you know, this is famously said all the time, is about 30% of that cost. But we need to get, if we got prices down to $700 to $900 a square foot, if we could build for that, you talk to developers, they want to sell for less.
Yeah.
They want a more liquid market. They're not making more money. Many of the developers right now are actually not just completing projects, launching projects and taking them through that construction cycle to keep the lights on, keep people employed and keep them busy, right? So, you know, we're not going to see a material, like, you agree, there is, you know, the contractors, the trades, they're more willing to flex right now than they have been. And we went through huge cost escalations. But again, you look at, I can't give you a number, but the extent to which some of those costs have come down in the last couple of years still doesn't account for the huge run-up.
Price level effect, right? Yep. You look at like building materials costs went up like 60% or something from 2019 to now. And like, yes, they've come off a little bit, but like,
yeah,
they're still much higher.
Yeah.
Well, and it's interesting because I've had been through a couple of presentation centers, or not even presentation centers, but buildings that are being built in the city of Vancouver that have units. The sticker shock, I feel like, you know, if people talk about Vancouver sticker shock, it's more dramatic right now than ever when you go, okay, this building's going to be built next year or whatever, great developer, mm-hmm. you know, great location. But the pricing is so unrelated to the market. And I think that's what's going on, right? You're looking at what's selling in the neighborhood
sure.
from 10 years ago right. and the new construction, you're going, this is so dramatic yep. of a gap mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and presumably they can't sell it for less.
Yeah.
Right. Because like they're not selling it. First off, they have people that are answering the phones, they're building it. And you know, my assumption is it just doesn't economically make sense to lower their prices.
You better believe they want to sell, right? You want to be able to get through that development cycle, deliver the homes, and redeploy the capital, right?
And pay out your the investors as well, right?
Yeah,
because a lot of it, the investors are not getting paid until everything's been sold, right? So I think, yeah, it's a real problem. And there's so much risk. I mean, this is what I wonder often about, like, you know, even if things change to get investors back to the region or to get developers building concrete towers, like memory versus having just gotten smacked. And I always think about the Okanagan when they have a major fire and then you think, oh, this is going to really impact the market. But then like next year, yeah. it's, mm-hmm. the market's doing fire? Well or whatever. Yeah. And it's short memory, so it's like the short memory span versus the like, well, I'll never do that again, or I'll never invest in Vancouver again because mm-hmm. the politics or the policy or whatever it is, right? It's a tough thing to think about, I think.
But so thinking of just kind of piggybacking off that a little bit, but the question I had was, so the memory is one thing. We've talked about the insane amount of purpose-built rental that's being built, right? It's a insane might be, is that overstating it? I don't know. It seems like there's
it's elevated, a lot. It's
elevated.
I think it's needed. It's needed, right. But it's a lot right now. Yeah.
But okay. So, cause we touched on it before, you know, the non-permanent residents, all the, you know, all the things that it's like rentals are being built. Everything else is going this way and it doesn't really make sense. What impact does that have on the resale market? I feel like it clearly has an impact on investors, right? Because you're like, okay, rents are going to presumably continue to decline.
Our forecast is that they'll decline again this year before increasing again. I think one dynamic that's important to note as context for this market is that essentially over the last 20 years, 80% of the net growth in the rental stock was in that secondary market, was due to, I mean, we like to vilify investors, don't we?
It was the only way we were providing rental units.
Well, yeah.
Through 30 years or something.
Absolutely. Right. We weren't it wasn't economical. It wasn't viable to build purpose built. On a side note too, somebody who brings an entire rental building to market and continues to own that and rent it is also an investor.
Yeah.
So they just own lots of units in the same building.
Right.
We're okay with that. We should be really okay with that. But it's funny then how we turn around and say, you investor driving up prices. Yes, this is a bad thing.
Although now in the States, it's the opposite, right? Aren't they institutional investors in single family home markets or potentially? Yeah. Anyway, yeah.
That's well, Trump.
Trump's going after
it. I think you just want something from them. I mean, you can't get something from someone if you don't threaten
them. Transactional?
I don't know. Maybe he definitely doesn't have a plan.
So I guess one thing is you're thinking your analysis shows rents declining this year, but then
increasing
rebounding
again. Yeah, yeah.
But turnover rents or average rents?
That's for new purpose built on a per square foot basis. That's what the basis is. That's what we're measuring. But you know, we see purpose built rental deliveries have very likely peaked as of last year. They'll still be elevated, but they should come off. There's, you know, famously, there are, you know, hundreds and hundreds of sites that have got their entitlements and, you know, they're ready to roll. But all of that supply won't come at once, right? And it's important to know who owns a site, right? Are you somebody like a historical landowner that's, you know, been adding value to the site because you want to sell it? Are you really going to develop? You know, we look at sort of, are you a blue chip developer owner versus a non? And so therefore, how likely is it that you're going to actually bring this potential project to market? There's a lot there. We need a lot of rental. The number of purpose-built rental units in Metro Vancouver per 1,000 people is about 40 today. It was 70 35 years ago. That's a very crude sort of measure. It doesn't take into account, you know, incomes and age composition. But like, we just have not, like to Brendan's point, we haven't been investing in purpose-built. We need it. There's just a lot coming
right
now. But
feels
I think
like everything right now, it's either the tap's on or it's off. There's no in between.
But we've hit an inflection point. We will continue to see more rental added in the future than we have in the past.
How, if at all, does that impact the resale market in your guys' minds?
Like, I think what's the relationship on the investor side of things? If you used to have people who in like Surrey and Langley, especially, they would buy a single family home, put in two basement suites or whatever, two suites. Rent it out, right? That's just not going to be happening. It's going to be really just hard to fill those units, and maybe the rents don't make sense. Like, maybe that project just doesn't work economically. So like, it's just like, you know, if rents are coming down, it's just going to be less investor demand, and then sales will be a bit soft. I don't think sales this year are going to be another century low, right? But I think a gradual pickup in sales, but it's going to be, you know, a good year for Vancouver is like 30, 32. Maybe we do like 26, 27 this year instead of 23. Like that's a win in my books. I know that we're not going to come roaring back, but you know, I think that sales are going to pick up. Same thing in the Fraser Valley. Like, they struggled to even sell 1,000 units a month last year. Mm-hmm. Maybe we get back to like 14, not 18, right? So mm-hmm. I think things will pick up. That doesn't mean I think it's going to be a strong year.
Yeah. And is it, so back half is what most people are saying. Are you thinking it's picking
up? That's so funny. That's like such an economist thing. It's like, well, probably not now, but like maybe the second half
in
the
future. We'll talk then.
Some quirky time in the future. Yeah, but it's funny. Like our models have things just slowly grinding higher. So like, by the end of 2026, we're back to within 10% of the 10-year average. So again, like, not an awesome year in 2026, mm-hmm. but better.
Yeah.
And most of that's just fading uncertainty, just pent up demand in general is a pretty powerful force. Eventually those transactions are going to happen. Affordability is better. Like, there are things that make sense for sales to be rising in 2026. But again, like, it's going to be a below average year.
And pricing?
We've got average prices in Vancouver. I think like it's always a really exciting forecast, like flat to up one. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised anywhere between like down two and up one kind of thing. Like, inventory is like higher than it's been, but it's like, it's not that high, right? It's higher in the Fraser Valley. Vancouver is like basically where we want inventory to be long-term, right? And if sales are kind of coming back, the demand will be absorbed pretty easily. I don't see like prices moving a lot. You know, we've had basically flat prices for like 2 years. Mm-hmm. In almost every market, mm-hmm. which is kind of what we want after prices went up around BC by like 60% during the pandemic. Yeah, like we need pretty flat prices for a while. And that's what we're getting. I think we'll have another year of pretty flat prices.
We've kind of already discussed this earlier on, but I just want to make sure I ask it. Which markets are going to be most durable in the province in 2026?
I think the Okanagan. The Okanagan had a really strong end to the year. So I'm pretty optimistic about that market. It struggled for like many markets, but a little bit more so outside of, like, for markets outside the Lower Mainland. So I think like that market, especially Central Okanagan, Kelowna, I think will pick up. Kamloops, same story. Kootenay just seems to shrug off everything, but like, prices have risen a lot in that market. So I think there's maybe some affordability constraints starting to kick in. So maybe sales come off a bit. Like, the North will be okay. Yeah, generally, like, every market outside the Lower Mainland, I've got,
you know, like, where we are.
It's like the you remember in The Wire, and Stringer, there's that, you know, the Stringer Bell meme, like, when you get the word out that we're back up. That's like, that's the market outside of Metro Vancouver. Like, we're back up. It's just Lower Mainland's going to take a while to come back.
And what, in maybe, Ryan, just focusing on the Lower Mainland, let's go neighborhood by neighborhood. Where's the strong neighborhoods?
I'd actually say
your own neighborhood.
Yeah, mine. I would live where I live. actually, if we get away from geography, I think the cheat code is leaseholds, right? For buyers, like, you know, leasehold properties tend to transact about 20% below freeholds. And so, you know, we're seeing more and more of those opportunities arise for buyers and particularly investors, right? I mean, the math is a lot more favorable when you can totally get the home for 20% less than you could otherwise, right? So
put that 20% in Bitcoin.
Don't.
Just kidding. But yeah, no, you're right. Yeah, so you save 20% roughly to go into leasehold and more are being built.
More and more being built, and they'll continue to be more, right?
And it's going to presumably be normalized, right? Like that.
I think there's right now, yeah, I think the average person doesn't. There are questions around it. You go, because I don't understand it, I'm not going to play with it. I mean, essentially, you don't own the land, but you know, for all intents and purposes, especially if you're buying a new home, you have that home as long as you can be on this earth, right?
Right.
So, and also our data, we've looked at leasehold versus freehold price changes, and they move together. So yeah, you're buying lower, but that rate of appreciation and you know, as markets go up and down, so for freehold, so they do for leasehold as well. But you're not missing out on a rate of growth, right?
And there's lots of places in the world where leasehold is the only option, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think that's, it's, for some reason we have this real, there seems to be a real resistance in the market to it, but it's something that I think people will get used to.
I agree.
Maybe as a final question, I have a final question.
Okay.
What I've could,
six more?
No, but no, what's the biggest hurdle for the market in 2026? Or what's one thing that could blow the market up, totally change it? I'm just thinking, if we had this conversation last year, we'd be more optimistic than we are now. And the tariff thing would have exploded everything.
Yeah.
I'll go with the macro one. Worst case scenario for me is Supreme Court upholds Trump's IEEPA tariffs. So the tariffs that he's levying on the rest of, not on Canada, thankfully, but gives them a lot of leverage then in CUSMA negotiations to come to the table and say, accept a 25% tariff or a 15% tariff. That's our final offer, right? Because the president there would have been given constitutional authority to levy a tax, right? Which he currently doesn't have. I don't think that's going to happen, but that would be a really bad scenario for the Canadian economy, where all of a sudden we're plunged back into kind of the nightmare scenarios that we were modeling last time this year. I think more likely Supreme Court strikes down those tariffs, takes away some leverage. Those negotiations in CUSMA are still going to be messy, and doesn't mean we're going to come out with a great deal, but at least it takes away that like hammer of like, well, I can just put whatever tariff I want
right
on your country.
Yeah. That's a good one.
No, you know, I see, you know, obviously very concerning to anyone and everyone to see the attacks on the Federal Reserve.
That's a good one, yeah.
And, you know, how that could destabilize financial markets and real markets beyond that.
I would like Trump to watch one video about how the yield curve works. Because, like, the long end of the yield curve is what he's worried about. And there's a very good chance that if you lose Fed independence, term premium increases,
yep,
long end yield curve goes up, mortgage rates go up. It's actually, it's totally counterproductive.
Yeah, the exact opposite of what he was hoping to achieve.
I think what we're hoping for, I mean, the noise doesn't help our market, right? I think our job, we haven't talked about the job market and we don't have time right now, but, you know, we have our unemployment rate's been ticking upwards pretty steadily for a couple of years. Maybe it's starting to crest. And that's not the only measure of health, you know, of our labor market, but wages, you know, if people are concerned, a good proportion of people are worried about, can't remember what the number is, but Stats Canada's recent data showed that a good chunk of people are concerned about whether they're going to have a job in six to 12 months from now, right? If that's on your mind, you don't also go and buy a home.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, we need to, I hope that we are in a place 6 months and 12 months from now where we go like, oh, okay, right. Like inflation's been stable. Interest rates have been stable. The job market's tightening up. Wages, like there's hiring. And I feel a bit more confident in my financial position. And that will lead to more transactions, right? And the flip side is more chaos will create a bigger patch for us.
Longer, deeper
patch.
I hate bringing this up right at the end, but I feel like we can't not talk about it because it was probably the biggest news story in 2025, but just what you're hearing in terms of fear or overstated around the Cowichan decision, which we haven't talked about. But first of all, I mean, people in the development world, perhaps, are you hearing stuff? And also touring around the province, are you hearing stuff? And maybe just relaying some of that.
Yeah, I mean, all I would say is we need resolution sooner than later, right? The longer this goes, the worse it's going to be for our markets, our homeowners, our economy, investment. This needs to be resolved one way or the other. There needs to be clarity on what it means for every property owner in the province and the country, right? That's all I would say. So I think until that's resolved, until we have direction on what that ruling means for all the different stakeholders, it will be to a degree paralyzing. I mean, I'm aware of deals that were like land transactions that have not happened, that were on track to be signed, sealed, and delivered. And the buyer pulled back because there's just too much uncertainty, right? So, it's just something we need to sort out.
Yeah, certainty about property rights is the bedrock of capitalism. So the sooner we get that certainty, the better. I'm surprised I haven't got a lot of questions. Like between December and now, I haven't done that many speaking engagements. So I'm certainly, it's something that like I'm always waiting for people to ask in the Q&A, but it hasn't come up a lot yet, but that doesn't mean that it won't for the rest of the year. You guys did a great show about it. And
see those comments in the comment section on YouTube.
And yeah,
Trevor, people are definitely wading in.
Yeah, our CEO, yeah. Trevor Coots, did a great job on that front. So I always defer to him for expertise. But yeah, I'm surprised it hasn't come up as much as I thought it would.
Amazing. Well, we always end the show with the five wire, rapid five fire. Light, hard-hearted questions. Well, we'll start with you. We'll start with Ryan, actually.
Okay. The funny thing is I always see Brendan always post photos of his books.
It's true.
Oh, yeah.
Some people do kids.
I feel
Brendan, Brendan does books. Nerd. But he'll have a good one, but we'll start with Ryan.
All right, Ryan, one book that you've read recently that you would recommend for our listeners.
It's not a book on economics. Believe it or not, I read other things. It's called Say Nothing About the Troubles in Northern Ireland.
Great book.
Have you read it?
Oh, is that Patrick Radden-Keefe?
Yes.
Yeah. Patrick Radden. And he also wrote a book, I think it's Empire of Pain, which I just got.
Yeah.
The Sackler family. But it's just, it's an amazing read. You know,
He's fantastic.
He's fantastic.
Yeah. The TV series about it was good too.
Oh, I didn't know there was one.
Oh, it's excellent. Yeah.
Oh, the opium.
No, that's great. But the Say Nothing. There's a miniseries.
It's wow.
It's phenomenal. That's a good one. That's a great book.
Right. Oh man,
Brendan.
I just finished Ian McEwan's latest book. I think it's called What We Can Know, which is it was brilliant. I really enjoyed it, and I'm currently reading the Aaron Ross Sorkin 1929,
anytime
these books come out, I read them. I'm like, I feel like I'm obligated to. I'm not sure I'm enjoying it, but like, I already know if you're an economist, like you know all this stuff.
Yeah,
it's good. He's a great writer. He makes it really interesting the way he writes about it. It's like
all the personalities.
Yeah, and it's really good. But sometimes when I'm reading those books, I'm like, am I just reading this because I have to? There's other things in my stack. Like there's that book about indie rock in the 90s. Like I would rather be reading that probably.
Yeah, yeah. But it's interesting. Guys like him can write a book that basically rehashes the same story that's been told.
Yeah.
And everybody goes, oh my God, this is unreal.
Pages.
I know. I don't know when you get to that level where you can just rewrite somebody else's book.
I'm waiting for something novel in it. I watched an interview with him where he was talking about how he got like access to the New York Fed's minutes, which they like hadn't released, even though the stuff all happened 100 years ago.
Huh.
So maybe there's some interesting stuff in there that hasn't been out before. But anyway, I'm about 100 pages in. It's very good. I'm just like, you know, it is what it is.
Question Adam? Number two. All right. In the last few years, what new belief, behavior, or habit has most improved your life? Ryan?
Or New Year's resolution. I think we're on quit day, or is that tomorrow? Something. I think it's
what's quit day? What's quit day?
Everyone gives up.
14th or 16th of January.
Yeah,
I stopped going to the gym tomorrow. Right. Anyway, what's yours?
Waking up earlier and like creating space for myself in the morning. It's just the best. It's not the best opening my eyes at like 4:35 o'clock. But like 2 minutes after that, I've got, you know, you normally have a house. I've got a wife, two kids, and a dog. Everybody's asleep then, right? So I just find that's my most productive time of the day. And I judge everyone else who sleeps in.
Yeah. You get up, really? I'm up at 5.
I talk about it as much as possible.
Yeah, it's like when you're vegan.
I have.
That's right.
I have three resolutions. I'm going 3 for 3 this year. One is just quit doom scrolling. So far, pretty good. I still like scroll, but if I find myself doing it when I could be doing anything else, I stop. The second one is to set a PR on the bench. It's going down, definitely. Maybe in the next 2 months.
Down in what you lift? Or
no, that PR. I mean,
the PR is
the
coming.
Number I have in mind. Right. It's going up. Yes. And the third one was to make a perfect beef bourguignon, which I tried on New Year's Day. It was fine. I didn't use enough wine.
We'll have to have you back.
Let's check back in on all three.
Which came true? That's great.
Binge watching, favorite movie. I spent a lot of time watching movies over the holidays.
Brendan, you start.
Okay. Binge watching, I'm currently binging through the show Banshee, which came out in like the teens. It's funny because it's a Cinemax show and it has everything you would expect from a Cinemax show, if you know, you know. But it's like way better than it needs to be. So like, and it has like Anthony Starr is the star of it. He's the guy who plays Homelander in The Boys. Tom Pelfrey is in it, who was in Task.
What's the storyline?
It's a criminal comes to a town looking for his partner after 15 years in prison, and he ends up becoming the sheriff of this town in Pennsylvania, I think. It's very violent. And it's great. I watch it while I'm setting PRs. It's amazing. It's not a show, not a show for my wife. Anyway, so I'm binging through that and whatever else I'm watching. Very excited. Industry is back, and the industry is the best show on television.
Is that on HBO, right?
Yeah, phenomenal. The Pit is back too. The Pit's great. And then movies. I watched a million movies over the break. And I think a movie called Marty Supreme. Oh, I think I liked a lot.
Oh, okay.
Oh, you saw that?
Yeah.
It was really good.
Well, it's the Safdie brothers, and it's interesting. Or no, it's one of the Safdies. The Safdies usually direct together, like Uncut Gems.
Yeah.
Hard. That was a good time. But they split up this year, and one made The Smashing Machine, which I also watched, which was not.
That was horrible.
Horrible, right?
At the end of it, I was kind of waiting for a big reveal. Good,
but like the weird, like the narrator over all the fights was so cheesy.
The ending, everything
was bad. It was not good.
I was like, this, right. Like, I want that an hour and a half back.
Yeah. So that was Benny Safdie. And then his brother, Josh Safdie, made Marty Supreme with Ronald Bronstein. They worked together all the time. And it's great. It's more like, it's just frenetic and like tense. And it's Timothée Chalamet.
One battle after another.
Oh yeah, loved one, but
I haven't seen it. Yep.
Oh god,
you can't carve it out 3.5 hours.
Yeah,
okay.
but you know what?
It does moves.
Yeah, I feel like long movies are a challenge for me, but that one was
that's a phenomenal.
I mean, love that cast.
Yeah,
stuff.
You know what I've realized? Leo DiCaprio. I mean, I just didn't realize. I always thought he was a good actor, but he seems to be elevated now to like absolute next level. Anyway,
yeah. Yeah, he's incredible. Into comedy.
Yeah.
He's very funny. Benicio del Toro.
De Niro before Meet the Fockers.
Right?
Yeah. I watch a lot of these documentary miniseries like where people are getting slaughtered. And they all blend together. And so I can't ever think of, I don't even know what I've seen, right? The last thing I actually binge watched was Squid Game. Years ago, I turned on the first episode. And I was like, this is so dark. I don't know when I'm going to be in the mood for this. And then I just went for it.
End of 2025.
Yeah. Went, yeah. It seems to fit the time. It's the time.
Set your calendar.
Yeah. I've got like, you know, like many of us, I've got my laptop with me, you know, usually when I'm watching. And of course, it's subtitled and stuff. And so, but I get so comfortable with all the characters and kind of like the trajectory of the plot that like, there'd be times I'm just like working away on my computer and I'm listening to like Korean and I think like I know what's going on. I have to 10 minutes later, I'm like, I actually have no idea what anyone said.
Wait a minute, I don't speak Korean.
I don't speak. I felt like I did for a while there, but anyway.
That's great. Squid Game. Okay. Favorite band or music? And Brendan, we'll start with you on this one. And maybe specific to YouTube.
Yeah, well, right now, if you're a middle-aged dad, there is no better activity on a Saturday night than a tall pour of whiskey and watching the Bruce Springsteen Live Nebraska, where he just plays Nebraska beginning to end. Fantastic. Probably one of my favorite albums of all time.
Oh, man, my pen's smoking
that's,
here.
Live that's another movie. Nebraska.
Oh, yeah.
Fell flat, eh?
God, I loved it for 90 minutes, and then it just fell apart in the last
20. I didn't want the Bruce Springsteen biopic.
Deliver me from nowhere.
Yeah. I was so excited to see that, and then I saw on Rotten Tomatoes, it was like...
It is...
Score well.
Yeah, I was like texting some friends about it. I was like, this might be like 30 minutes in. This might be the best movie ever made. It was New Year's Eve. Yeah. I'd had a lot to drink. And I was like, this is terrible.
Yeah, Jeremy Allen White. Yeah,
I'll spoil. I'm going to spoil the ending because it a little bit. Not totally. Yeah. Bruce Springsteen lives.
Right.
But there's at the very end, like it's a very dark movie. It's like, it's very quiet and it's Bruce Springsteen depressed and making this album he wants to make that doesn't really have hits on it and whatever. And it's great. But then at the end, he like plays a concert and then I think it ends with him, like he sits on his dad's lap, but they're both adults. Yeah. And like, it's really weird. It's just a really weird ending that threw me off.
I want to get out of this conversation. That's so uncomfortable. Talk about
it. It's very small because Stephen Graham plays his dad, and Stephen Graham's probably 5'5" and Jeremy Allen White's probably like 5'5". So it's just a really small man sitting on another very small man's lap. And it's just like, what is happening right now?
So it's not like Kevin Costner playing catch with his dad in the Field of Dreams. Yeah. It's not like that.
No, that was heartwarming. I wish they had a catch. That would have been great.
I feel like, man, I can't remember any of your music choices, Ryan. I feel like Andy Ramlow said War on Drugs, which
makes sense.
I've actually been listening.
My wife was on her Spotify Wrapped was in the top 0.1% of listeners to War on Drugs.
Oh, really?
She loves War on Drugs.
Yeah. What music?
I'm big into like indie and folk and
you like War on Drugs?
I do like War on Drugs. I listen to a lot of Laura Chiron, but Ruben in the Dark.
Oh, I think Lord Huron, you've...
Oh, you, that might... Yeah.
What it was Ruben in the Dark. Which I just... The sound... So my wife and I have seen him at the Hollywood on Broadway here like 4 or 5 times. He's back on February 13th. We're going to see him again. Nice, intimate setting there. We cannot figure out why this guy is not filling arenas. The sounds are incredible. Great vibe. If you have a hot tub... It's like, that's my hot tub music. I'm in the hot tub, I'm like...
The genre, hot tub music.
I don't need stimulation, okay? I need to find moments to relax. But anyway, I recommend him and his crew.
I'll have to check that out.
Yeah. All right, last but not least, Matt, you want to take it?
Something you have purchased for under $1,500. We haven't raised the price in 10 years and 500 episodes.
Groceries.
Yeah, exactly. This used to be a meaningful amount of money.
Coffee and
steak. Yeah, Costco run. Brendan.
I got a new power cage for my gym. It's got a pulley system now with plate-loaded pulley system. So this is one of the reasons why this PR is going down. We're doing some real work.
Nothing like a new gym to motivate.
That's right.
You're one of the few people I know that has a home gym that is actually in use.
Yeah.
I also don't know a lot of power lifters. You know who's a power lifter is from the Valley? The Partners. Trevor Street.
Trevor Street. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't know a lot of... Most people, though, are...
I only have a couple years. I only have a couple years left.
Yeah.
So I gotta.
Well, next time we're gonna add to the five wire what the PR was and did you smash it?
Yeah.
I failed it. I actually failed it this in 2025.
And you failed it on your own, or do you have a Smith machine or what?
No. I got there's spotters. So And I don't put collars on, so I can just dump it if I needed to. Makes a lot of noise, but yeah.
Wow.
Right. For me, stand up paddleboard.
Ooh. Oh, yeah.
Which I'm not using nearly as much as I should, but it's just like, I like having it because I feel like I could be free.
That's right.
It's
in the trunk just waiting.
Do you know where I can go with this thing? But my goal is
to say that to your wife.
Do you know where I can go?
Watch your tone. I'm going to Deep Cove.
I'm going on the paddleboard. Yeah.
That's a good one, though.
What's his name? Ruben in the Dark. Is it paddleboard music?
Oh, it is for sure. It's everything.
go.
Anything, probably not powerlifting music.
I watch Banshee while I'm powerlifting.
Yeah. I'm going to, Banshee's in bold caps here, so we're definitely watching Banshee. Well, how can we find out more about what you guys are up to? Maybe starting with Brendan, if anyone wants to follow along or check out BCREA.
Yeah, you can go to our website. We have an economics page you can go to where we put up all of our research and all of our stats, and follow me on LinkedIn and I think Blue Sky. Though on Blue Sky, I don't post really anything.
Yeah, you're kind of prolific on LinkedIn.
On LinkedIn, all
Blue Sky is like the most boring place on the planet.
Blue Sky is like full of all the same person. Yeah. LinkedIn is starting to bug me. There's a few times I've been like, should I just quit all social
media? Pull the plug.
But yeah, it's just, you load up. I wish there's like a way to mute like just categories of people or topics, because it's just such a drag sometimes opening up that site. But yeah.
And Ryan, we're big fans of Rennie. What's the best way to follow Rennie?
Yeah, I mean, Rennie.com/intelligence. We post reports every month there.
Mailing list as well.
Yeah, you can sign up there and get on our mailing list. Like Brendan, we publish topical pieces as well, depending on what's going on in the world. I'm on LinkedIn, not as prolific as this gentleman.
Prolific's like a post a week or something.
Well, yeah. I was talking to our social media person and she's like, you need to do more. And I said, well, like, what's more? She's like, one a week. I'm like, that sounds like a lot.
Yeah, I can't do that. I'm out.
But you guys do a lot. Like, you guys do so much more video and stuff. And you guys do a podcast.
Yes, there is. I don't even know where my likeness is appearing. I'm not being paid for it. I know that.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, thank you guys for coming on. Yeah, episode 500. I think this is a hit.
Send the books.
It was a banger. This might be the best one.
Best one, yeah.
Send PRs on podcasts, dude.
All right.
So there you have it, folks. Our discussion with Chief Economist at BCREA, Brendan Augmentson, and Chief Economist at Rennie, Ryan Berlin.
I really like hanging out with those guys. You know, it's funny. We had a great conversation afterwards. Both busy guys, but I think that was a pretty fun morning for everybody. We got to talk about the market. Got to catch up on their five wire, which is always good. And a lot of good takeaways.
Yeah, no, it's great having those guys. I feel like maybe setting up like a round table where we can potentially talk to those guys more often would be great.
Yeah, I actually think the round table, I mean, we've had a lot of round tables and debates on this podcast over 500 episodes. And, it's they're always some of my favorite episodes, just because it's sometimes hard to, like, you almost have to moderate a bit, but it's always, I mean, you always end up with really great ideas. And it's amazing how, you know, somebody talks about something and you feel the need to kind of piggyback on it. So you go places that you typically wouldn't necessarily go, and just a tete-a-tete one-on-one.
Absolutely. Yeah. So what else do we have before we cut for the day? We have VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. This is our website where all things real estate related live. Head over there, Adam, to check out the back catalog and an assortment of things. But I want to try something a little bit different. We have resources for buyers. We have resources for sellers. We also have worked with a ton of people that listen to this podcast over the last 500 episodes. And I feel like we should just say, we love working with people from the podcast. We have a 5-star track record on Google. So if you're interested in buying or selling and you want to work with us, just get in touch. And you can do that at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
For sure, Matt. And if someone wants to get in touch with you directly, how can they do so?
They can try me at any time, 778-847-2854 or Matt@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Or you can try me at 778-866-4574 or Adam@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
And of course, we got that nonpartisan line, info@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. Well, I can't believe it, Adam. We're in a new year. We're in a new 100 of episodes, and the future is bright.
The future is bright. See you at 600. Coming soon.
By the way, Mayor Brad West is on next week.
Oh, yeah.
No big deal.
Yeah, by the way.
No big deal. We buried the lead there a bit. So see you next week.
Take care.
2,000 Spaces for Radio.
Subscribe today.